A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 5, 1998, entitled A Declaration of Interdependence. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 33, verses 10 through 22, Romans 12, verse 21, and Matthew 5, verses 38 through 48. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
We celebrate this weekend the independence of this nation 222 years ago, declared and experienced ever since in a growing experience of freedom and liberty. So blessed of God, as we just sang, God's grace has rested on us as a people. We have been fortunate indeed. And it is certainly proper to celebrate that independence in public festivals, and I believe as well to recognize it in divine worship, because I do believe that the freedom that we have experienced is the consequence of a biblical vision. Not as the religious right would claim that this is a Christian nation, but that Judeo-Christian tradition shaped particularly in the founding story of Israel, where Moses leads a slave people out of bondage and domination to freedom, and where the Hebrew prophets shaped that idea of the shalom of God, the kingdom where lion and lamb lie down together, where there is justice and peace. Certainly, that which has come to actuality in this United States of America is a consequence of some things that were seen correctly, some insights, some, I believe, biblical insights that have been put into practice. We have been a blessed people indeed, free beyond any before us. And this nation was founded with a vision, a radical vision, of the limitation of government coming out of the background of Europe with its divine right of kings and its nobility and that kind of hierarchy of being. This nation was created for the government by the people and for the people and of the people. And there's something right about it. And there has been something wonderful in the living of it. The vision from the beginning certainly had its flaws, and it has been betrayed in those 222 years many, many times, and still is betrayed. There's no cause for boasting, for pride, for triumphalism. There is cause for genuine humility and thanksgiving that we have been a people that have been thus blessed to live with a measure of freedom unmatched anywhere. And so we do celebrate it. And we recognize that our forebears made a radical, daring, bold endeavor. And it is time in this 20th century drawing to its close, the dawning of century 21 and the arrival of the third millennium, it is time for an equally bold and daring vision. An equally bold and daring vision, now a declaration not of independence, but of interdependence. And as the world's only at present superpower, it is incumbent upon the United States of America to take the lead in recognizing the interrelatedness of the whole of reality and the interlocking nature of all of our human existence. That people are not, first of all, members of tribes and nations divided by various barriers, but are indeed citizens of this planet, Earth's children. It is incumbent upon us, from a position of power, to take the lead to make a declaration of interdependence with all of Earth's peoples. That is not a wild-eyed dream. That is simply a very practical suggestion in the light of a world that is not dawning, but that has dawned, that is here. My favorite image, which I've shared with you many times, for the nature of the reality of the life in which we live today is that picture from the astronaut's camera in deep space that captured the Earth. That beautiful, fragile, blue and green globe suspended in frozen space. For the first time in world cosmic history, the human family has been able to visualize itself as it really is. As the astronaut said, any barriers, any divisions, every boundary is superficial. For the reality is that we are totally interrelated and part of one whole. That's the reality of our situation. But the life that we are now living is taking on all of the marks of that reality. We are experiencing in our day, through the amazing accomplishments of technology, the interlacing of the whole globe into a global family, creating a global consciousness as never before. You well know that I'm a dinosaur with these things, but I do stand in awe at the technology that brings us into intimate connection with the whole world. But it is not only the technology that has done it, but global travel has become commonplace. And beyond that, beyond any of that, beyond the physical fact that we are one, beyond the technology that is enabling us to experience oneness, beyond all of that is that connectedness that is coming through the recognition that we all breathe the same air, that the ecological concern for a clean environment is a world global concern that cannot be addressed alone, that conflicts, wherever they are in the globe, must be addressed. We cannot, as the United States of America, turn our backs on the continuing conflict and tension in the Middle East. We cannot wash our hands of the anguish of the Balkans. We cannot sit apart from the nuclear testing going on in India and Pakistan. It has implications for the safety of the world, it has implications for the air that we breathe and the globe of which we're a part. There is no longer an insulating and an isolating possible. For decades and even centuries, we lived in the security of oceans to the left and oceans to the right, and it doesn't make any difference anymore. We are a superpower in a world that has shrunken and that is marked by a global consciousness, global communication, global realities all together. And if that isn't enough, it's the economy, stupid. It is the interlocking of peoples and nations through economic investment and trade and commerce that really carries the clout. Multinational corporations, international banking, this world is one. We bail out Mexico, we cajole Indonesia, we buttress the yen in the land of the rising sun, and we do it. We do it not because we Americans have altruism running through our blood. We do it because America, which is marked by productivity and the bottom line, needs a stable world in which to have a stable market in which to consume the goods that we produce with increasing efficiency. We are one. And the irony, I see it as an irony, the irony is that the most potent reality that we live and experience and that affects the change is economy. One would have thought that with the reality that we are living that has come upon us full-blown, that it might have been the religions that would be leading peoples and nations and tribes into a common understanding and mutuality. But the religions continue to provide the fuel for divisiveness and separation. Isn't it ironic that what one would have thought would have come out of the religious vision comes out rather of the economic vision? This is a new age. It is a new world. Those words have been spoken by preachers and pulpits from time immemorial. Every preacher, every week, deals with the greatest crisis in the world and brings the greatest solution in the world. I mean, we're all the same. It's the same crisis, it just gets a different label every week. But it's different. I'm telling you, there's something new out there. This is not business as usual. This is not just pulpit pulp. This is not just preacher's cant. We need a transformation of consciousness. We need to think differently than we've ever thought before. We can no longer afford the mentality and the spirit that led to the Declaration of Independence. It is incumbent upon us to make as daring and bold a move now to declare the interdependence of the whole human family and the whole global reality. And as we celebrate the 4th of July weekend, we have right close to us an instance of how concrete and practical this is. I say close to us across the state in Flint. 4th of July was celebrated by picketers on the line waving flags and wearing the red, white, and blue. And we know that there is a crisis in the community of Flint, a strike going on between the laborers and the great corporation General Motors. And what we are talking about this morning is not irrelevant to that situation. We can grumble about the corporate leadership that allowed the store to be given away a long time ago or didn't anticipate the present situation soon enough. But we have to grant them that they cannot continue to be a corporation with any kind of profitability, that is, a corporation that can continue to exist with business as usual. Change is absolutely necessary. That seems obvious. But we also recognize there are laborers there, people whose whole lives have been there, people whose whole destiny seems wrapped up in the continuation of that employment. And so we can grumble at the UAW, who calls a strike that exacerbates the situation. It would seem only to speed up the inevitable that General Motors will move out of Flint someday because it cannot profitably operate there. And the problem that they're trying to avoid there is the loss of jobs through the export of jobs, the outsourcing, perhaps beyond our borders. It's a very complex problem. It is not easily solved, and there are good people on both sides, and there are corrupt and greedy and normal human beings on both sides. But globalization and the reality in which we are living in our day demands a transformation in consciousness, because corporate America will sometime or other run afoul if it considers only the bottom line, and the labor movement will run afoul if it considers it well only if I have my job at a good wage. If we do not recognize the complexity of the situation and the ongoing historical development, there will be trouble afoot everywhere. There are those in my ivory tower, shrinky kind of profession who decry globalization, who say we have to return to regionalization and to the distinctiveness and particularity of cultures, to buying and selling and sourcing from within a smaller region, unless we come to a bland kind of universalism, a globalism that loses all of the distinctiveness of peoples and cultures. I understand that, but I don't think it's practical. I don't think it's going to go that way. I think the whole tide of history is moving to one world. We are being driven to one world, and who knows but what the Creator Spirit is involved in that move, which overcomes all barriers, all boundaries, and all divisions, not to create that bland universalism, but to create a situation where the interconnectedness and interlockedness of all with all is recognized and therefore dealt with. What we really need in our day is a transformation of consciousness, and what we need is someone like Karl Marx. Karl Marx, 150 years ago, 1848, published the Communist Manifesto with Friedrich Engels. And Marx dealt with economy, and we've written him off. He's the monster that created the Soviet horror and threatens our whole conception of things and how things ought to be. But Karl Marx, well, we call him an economic determinist, and economic determinism has a bad smell. And yet, I wonder if Karl Marx wasn't more right than anyone has given him credit for, or he even realized. When I first came back to this congregation in 1971, a church was being closed, a congregation that should have been closed 7 years earlier. It took 7 years to close it. There was crying and weeping and gnashing of teeth. Keep this little band of people alive as a congregation. It was ridiculous. It took 7 years to do what should have been done post haste. At that time, I formulated Rehm's Law. It goes like this: piety prevails until pennies pinch. Which goes to say that Karl Marx was right. The economic factor is a tremendously powerful determining factor in human society. Now, Karl Marx, however, was not really talking about economics. He wasn't really concerned. He wasn't an economist. He was a philosopher. He was a dreamer. And what he was concerned about was the human condition. What he was concerned about was human society, human well-being as a whole, human community. He happened to be wrong about the ability of the forces of capital to take on board the proletariat and therefore stave off what he saw as inevitable revolution. But on this 150th anniversary of his Communist Manifesto, there are a number of books being written. And in a recent New York Times article, there were reviews of some of these books, and they differ on the pro and the con, one side and another, as you might expect. But the thing that they all seem to agree with is that what Marx did see was what we are living today. That is the tremendous power of capital to produce wealth and the conditions of our world such as we are experiencing them. He saw it. He didn't like it. He didn't see the positive side that we have been blessed with. But my point is this. There was a prophet who saw something. And it's not accidental that Marx's philosophy has been called a Christian or a biblical heresy, because Marx was rooted in the scriptures of the Old Testament. And it was a vision. It was a vision of a society in which there is justice and in which there is peace. And in all the ways that he was wrong, what must be granted to him is that he was concerned about human community and human well-being. And what I would say today on this 4th of July weekend in 1998, on the threshold of Century 21 and Millennium 3, is that we need such a prophet to arise to catch the fancy of the world, to create an alternative vision. Because if we continue with a militant mind and a hostile spirit to build walls and to divide humankind, we will eventually blow ourselves up. We have such technology, such efficiency, that we will ruin the world and cut out the future unless we begin to think differently. A transformation of consciousness. And probably we need to begin where the psalmist began, who recognized that God is God after all, and that God fills the whole earth with steadfast love. The image of God that the psalmist held is not an image that I can hold, because the psalmist saw God up on some throne there just out of sight, who managed the affairs of this world. I don't think it's quite that simple, but what the psalmist understood is certainly true. That is, that there is no human sovereignty that can manage things, no human planning or strategy that can secure the world. He says God sits in the heavens and he laughs at us scurrying around with our grand plans and efforts to secure ourselves. The king is a symbol of human sovereignty, and he says a king is not saved by his armies. War horses are no guarantee of victory. Rather, the steadfast love of God. Our hope is in God. We hope in thee. And so, to human pride, to human hubris, to human arrogant self-affirmation, the biblical vision is to recognize that we are grounded in God, and there is something operative beyond our scheming. And the spirit and the attitude with which I believe we need to live in this age of ours was reflected by Paul in response to his encounter with Jesus Christ. He had just been talking about the grace of God, including Jew and Gentile, in the end of the 11th chapter of Romans, that magnificent paragraph that says, "Therefore God will have mercy on all." To God, source, guide, and goal of all there is, be glory now and forever. And then, after speaking about the magnificence of the grace and the mercy of God, he comes to chapter 12 and says, "I beseech you, therefore, brothers and sisters, on the basis of the mercy of God, present yourselves a sacrifice to God, living, holy, acceptable, proving the will of God." And he says to them, "Through the renewing of your mind, this is your logical service." The reading, the translation I read said spiritual worship. That's not very good. The word is the same word from which we get logic, the Greek word from which we get logic. Paul is saying, as a matter of fact, God being as God is, mercy being at the heart and core of things, then it is only reasonable, it makes sense, it is logical to present yourselves holy to God and to allow God to renew your mind so that you think differently, so that you don't think as the human animal thinks naturally. We're talking about the transformation of consciousness. We're talking about a radical shift in the way we think. And he makes it very practical at the tail end of that chapter where he talks about, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all. And don't give evil for evil, but respond to evil with good, and thereby you put coals of fire on your adversary's head, not to say, ha ha ha, now your head's burning, but to do something to change the inside of the other. Because violence begets violence, evil begets evil in this world, in this natural world, in our natural response. And Paul is saying, you come to Jesus Christ and are transformed in your thinking. There's an alternative consciousness now, so that you return good for evil. And you give, you lend, you respond in a most ridiculous fashion, in which case he was simply reflecting Jesus, who said the old system is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, tit for tat. But I say to you, love your enemies. Somebody wants you to go a mile, go two. Somebody wants your coat, give them your shirt too. Somebody slaps you on the cheek, present the other. And you'll be like God who causes rain to fall on the just and the unjust. You'll be like God who causes the sun to rise on the good and the evil. The simple thing that Jesus requests of us is that we be perfect. But the word perfect is really not the word perfect like I got a perfect A report card or something like that. It's more the word, the nuance is mature. Jesus said, be mature. As God is mature, for God's sake, grow up. For God's sake, recognize the nature of the reality of which you're a part. For God's sake, recognize the only possibility for a future for this world that is peopled by animals like human beings who have minds, who have genius, and who are corrupt and greedy and selfish and self-centered. Recognize that the only possibility is a transformation of human personality. The Sermon on the Mount is so impractical. I mean, it sounds so nice, it almost makes the person cry. But it won't work, of course. That's why for years and years I didn't preach on it. Because, well, it won't work. And I would not reduce it to what sometimes it's reduced to, and that's just a little personal piety, a kind of spiritual, individual kind of thing. And then, now I get to this advanced age, at that thin line between mature thinking and senility. And I gotta say to you folks, the Sermon on the Mount is the most practical political document that's ever been written. You don't have to believe it, but I am certain that there is no other way for a human, humane future and to follow the blueprint of the Sermon on the Mount. Hans Küng, in discussing in his book Judaism, which is a wonderful study of Judaism, he mentions concretely the situation between Israel and the Palestinians. and that in his encounter with the Likud party, the conservative Orthodox party, that the word that he hears constantly is retaliation. And there is something in me, because I really do love Israel, there's something in me that when someone does something to Israel and they rise up and strike, not an eye for an eye, but a whole village for an eye, there's something in my blood that runs fast. My heart beats. I say, get them. Sick them, Israel. But Kung suggests that the Jew Jesus suggests that retaliation begets retaliation. And the Jew Jesus suggested the possibility of the renunciation of rights and power. The voluntary renunciation of rights and power. And everything in my human being rebels against that. But I do believe that is the only hope. I do believe that is the biblical imperative. I do believe that is the way of Jesus. And that really there is no other way to peace.